KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer in Rome. Pope Francis has been laid to rest at a church in central Rome, the first pope in more than a century to be buried outside the Vatican. Next comes the conclave. We take you to the room where it happens.
The magnificence of that chapel will be focusing everything we try and do.
Cardinal Nichols will be inside the Sistine Chapel for his first conclave.
It's intimidating, frankly.
Plus, Elon Musk at 100 days, concerns over the country's birth rate, and we talk to Gina Davis, actor and now children's book author. It's Sunday, April 27th. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. It appears that efforts are back on track to revive peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. President Trump held a brief discussion with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Vatican yesterday. They were both there to attend the funeral of Pope Francis. NPR's Asma Khalid reports the White House has offered few details about what the two leaders discussed.
President Trump has been eager to end the now three-year war in Ukraine, and so the Trump administration has been pushing a deal that seems to favor Russia. But on social media yesterday, had a post in which he criticized his Russian counterpart, saying there was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas. President Trump also questioned whether Putin was indeed really serious about wanting to end the war and suggested maybe he ought to put sanctions on Russia.
NPR's Asma Khalid reporting. The first black labor secretary in U.S. history has died. NPR's Tom Dreisbach reports Alexis Herman served in the administrations of both Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and is being remembered as a trailblazer for civil rights.
Alexis Herman was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1947 during Jim Crow. After graduating from Xavier University in Louisiana, she worked to desegregate schools, became a social worker. She served in the administration of President Jimmy Carter, and under President Bill Clinton, she became the country's first black Secretary of Labor. Throughout her career in politics, Herman encouraged young people to get more involved, like in this 2016 commencement address.
I fought for civil rights. I fought for voting rights. I fought for women's rights in the 70s, but now it is your turn.
Herman was 77 years old. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
At least nine people were killed after a man drove a vehicle into a crowded street festival in Vancouver last night. More than 20 others were injured. Dan Karpinchuk reports Canadian party leaders are calling it a senseless and horrifying incident at the end of a national election campaign.
Vancouver's interim police chief, Steve Rye, says a 30-year-old man is in custody after plowing his SUV at high speed into the crowd.
When it occurred, from my understanding, prior to police arrival, he was taken into custody by people in the crowd.
Rye says he's confident it was not an act of terrorism. Canada's new Democratic Party leader, Jasmeet Singh, had just left the festival and said he was horrified by the attack. Liberal leader Mark Carney and Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre said they were shocked and devastated. Carney said his campaign plans for BC have changed because of the incident. Monday's election will determine Canada's next prime minister. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip say they have received the remains of 51 Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes in the last 24 hours. Gaza's health ministry says the overall Palestinian death toll has surpassed 52,000 since the war broke out. Israel ended its ceasefire with Hamas by launching a series of airstrikes in the region in March. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has appointed a new vice president. It's a move to help secure a successor for the 89-year-old who's been pushing for a bigger role in a post-war Gaza. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports from Tel Aviv.
The new vice president of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, is 64-year-old veteran politician Hussein Sheikh from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. He's a close ally of President Mahmoud Abbas, who's been in power for more than two decades. Sheikh spent 11 years in Israeli prisons and became a leader in the Fatah party. The role of vice president didn't exist before last week, and it's seen as Abbas's way to signal his choice for who should take over once he passes. Hamas and the PLO are rivals, and relations between the two Palestinian groups have been strained since Hamas seized control of Gaza in 2007. Hamas has called the Sheikh's appointment a, quote, reprehensible step. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Rescue teams worked through the night to contain a fire from a massive explosion at a port in southern Iran. Officials say the blast killed at least 25 people and injured hundreds of others. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer in Rome, where Pope Francis has been laid to rest and preparations are underway to choose his successor. The conclave will be held in the Sistine Chapel under a ceiling of Michelangelo's frescoes. This week I snagged one of the last tickets to go inside that famous chapel before the College of Cardinals takes it over. We began in a tourist traffic jam with a tour guide named Guido Airoldi.
Well, this is Vatican City.
Within Vatican City is the Sistine Chapel, named for Pope Sixtus IV, who oversaw renovations here in the late 15th century. As we inch toward the building, we see it's actually
very unimpressive from the outside because it's a private chapel. There's no square, no fountains, and it's the only way to get into the Sistine Chapel is to go through the Papal Palace, is where we are now.
The Papal Palace is vast. It houses the Vatican Library, government offices, papal apartments, and museums full of ancient Roman sculptures, Gothic gargoyles, Etruscan artifacts, and Renaissance masterpieces.
Here we have angels with trumpets announcing the beginning of judgment, souls climbing to heaven, and souls being thrown into hell.
On the day Pope Francis died, 135 of the Catholic Church's cardinals were under age 80, making them eligible for this conclave. They will not wind their way to the chapel the way we are, though.
First, they go and visit a chapel called the Pauline Chapel, where they pray God to inspire them for what they're about to do. And then it's a procession. The cardinals come through a huge door, which is now closed, wooden door, in the Sistine Chapel. They all come in and they sign their name and other rituals that we don't know about.
What we do know is that they'll sleep in a hotel adjacent to the chapel. It's where Pope Francis himself lived, in a break with tradition, rather than in the papal palace. For the conclave, the chapel will be transformed.
They need to bring a special floor, special tables and chairs. They need to bring the stove and the pipe and the chimney. They have to put the chimney.
The famous white smoke.
Yes, they have to arrange the chapel for the election.
The Vatican says the special floor protects marble inlay and provides a more level surface. But an American priest who runs a think tank in Rome, Father Robert Sirico, tells NPR the floor also has cell phone jamming devices underneath it to prevent cardinals from leaking information, and in a very modern way, keep them locked away from the outside world as per ancient tradition, says Airoldi, our guide.
And that's since centuries. That's why it's called conclave, because they were locked up there, cum clave, with key.
But the doors are not locked yet, and we're about to go in. Because talking is discouraged once you enter the chapel, Airoldi sets the scene with pictures he has on hand.
The ceiling, Michelangelo's ceiling, with the most famous scene, the creation of Adam in the image of God.
And explains the backstory of how one of the most famous artworks of all time, the fresco commissioned by Pope Julius II, almost didn't get painted.
Michelangelo doesn't want to work here. He's a sculptor, he's not interested in doing this. But the Pope has made up his mind, and you have to understand that in those days, if you refuse to work for a Pope, your career is over anyway. So you might as well give it a try.
So Michelangelo did, and then went back to sculpture and hardly ever painted again. I mean, why would you?
Okay, here's the Sistine Chapel. To exit, you go to the left.
And with that, 3 hours after we arrived and well-prepped by Airoldi, we're ushered into the Sistine Chapel itself with about 500 other tourists.
There are children, there's a man in crutches here, but even shoulder to shoulder with several hundred people, it is incredible. And right up at the center on the ceiling is Adam reaching out and touching his finger with a bearded, gray-haired God.
It's Michelangelo's masterpiece, and it's breathtaking. Starting tomorrow, the crowds will be escorted out of here and the chapel shut. And when the conclave begins, Vincent Nichols will be inside.
When those doors shut, all of the, you know, it's conservative against liberal and all of that stuff, that will finish.
As the Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, Nichols is the church's top official for England and Wales. As a 79-year-old cardinal, he's also one of those 135 electors who will be making a very big decision for some 1.4 billion Catholics. In a walled garden behind a British seminary near the Vatican, he told us how he feels as he faces his first conclave.
It's intimidating, frankly. And I've brought to mind once or twice in these days what Pope John the 23rd wrote, that every night before he went to sleep, he would say, "Right, Lord," the kind of thing, "I'm signing off, I'm going to sleep. It's your church, you look after it."
For 8 hours, well,
yeah,
I sleep.
Yeah. And there's a bit of that.
Yeah. The College of Cardinals is more diverse than at any time in history. Many appointed, like yourself, by Pope Francis. Have you met your fellow cardinals? Are you talking on the phone these days and weeks?
That's what these days are for.
Yes.
We'll have a full week or more just to be together and to listen to each other's stories and before we go in.
And this is your first conclave. Are you consulting others who've been to conclaves before? What should I expect? Any
only,
tips, advice?
Only a little. Only a little, yeah. Now, my predecessor was at conclave, and the one before that. But they both died, so they've left me some memories.
Right, right. You are the son of two teachers, I believe.
My goodness, you've done your research.
You've worked in education. Tell me about youth in the church, what role they should play, and what role the new Pope will play with them.
When I think about Pope Francis, I think he was in Poland at a World Youth Day. So there were more than a million young people present. And he said to them, "If you want to be a messenger of hope in the world, go and talk to your grandparents." So he would not want young people to see themselves in some kind of, you know, sealed compartment, nor would he want elderly people left, as he were, on the side.
Mm. In recent days in St. Peter's Square, we've spoken to so many people who had so much hope for the direction that Pope Francis brought the church in. We spoke to women who were really heartened by a larger role for women in the church under Pope Francis. Do you think the next pope will continue in the direction this pope headed in?
It's quite a complicated question, that, because I don't think for a moment we should confuse a few jobs here in Rome as a sign of the role that women play in life and in the life of the church, in the life of faith. A good friend of mine, she's 93 now, she's been a head teacher for years, and she quite happily says to me, "I've heard far more confessions than you have, you know." Yeah, because children give, you know, and that's where they start, and they're brought in. So it's quite a complicated question, and it's not just these kind of, neuralgic points. You've got to look a bit deeper.
What about how Pope Francis told priests it was okay to bless gay couples? It was okay for some divorced people to take communion. Are those directions that he pointed the church in irrevocable?
Well, in the Synod on the Family, 1980, I think it was, there was a long discussion which I was present at, and the distinction was made between the way in which we try to live the full commands of the Lord, which is always gradually. But that's not the same as saying that the law is gradual. Mm. It's our walking towards it. Now, that's what Pope Francis took and really developed. Mm. And that's why he said, for example, on gay marriage on the plane, who am I to judge? But his next phrase was, if people are striving to do the will of God. Now, so it was, we walk, it's not about condemnation, but it is about discerning where this is going. Mm-hmm. And if it will take you closer to that sense of the love of God in your life. And it's also very important, I think, I'm going on a bit, but it's also very important to understand that the commands of Jesus are given to his friends. If you love me, keep my commandments. So they're not kind of universal, you know, commands. They're if you want to learn life in its fullness, then this is the way we go.
Mm. Yeah. And what about Pope Francis's critics who saw those things as destabilizing for the traditions of the Church? What do you say to them?
Well, we talk about it, don't we?
Yeah.
And no doubt we will in the days to come. I think Pope Francis is very clear that it's not essentially a matter of conformity. It's a matter of love.
Someone in that room in the Sistine Chapel will walk out as Pope. Could it be you?
No, I don't think so, no. Come on, I'm nearly 80, and there's lots of other reasons as well. Yeah.
Cardinal Vincent Nichols, Archbishop of Westminster, thank you so much.
Okay.
I'm torn. Can I say I hope we see you in London? If we don't see you in London, we'll know where you are.
Oh, I hope you know.
This conversation and the visit to the Sistine Chapel that preceded it were produced by NPR's Fatima El-Kassab. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. At least 9 people are dead after a person drove a vehicle into a street festival in Vancouver last night. Officials in Canada say more than 20 others were injured. A suspect has been taken into custody. Authorities in Georgia are investigating the shooting death of a sheriff's deputy during a traffic stop near Augusta last night. A second officer was wounded. At least 28 people were killed after a massive explosion at a port in southern Iran. Authorities say hundreds of others were injured. The blast is believed to be linked to a shipment of a chemical ingredient used to make missile propellant. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer. This week will mark 100 days of billionaire Elon Musk working inside the federal government. While Musk's focus has been on cutting costs through the ad hoc Department of Government Efficiency team, his critics say he's also using his proximity to President Trump to help his own businesses. To help us break this down, we're joined by NPR tech correspondent Bobby Allen. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Bobby, Elon Musk has been working in the White House for almost 100 days. What has he accomplished?
Yeah, well, he's become the leader of President Trump's mission to cut government waste. When DOGE launched, Musk was promising to slash somewhere in the ballpark of $1 trillion from the federal budget. And so far, by its own accounting, it has saved only $160 billion. Now, I say only, but that is still a lot of money. But as my colleagues have reported, that figure appears to be quite inflated and riddled with accounting errors. So the exact amount of money saved is something of a moving target. But whatever the number is, Musk has been pushing hard to cancel contracts, lay off thousands of workers, and help dismantle entire agencies. Recently, Musk did say he'll soon be stepping back from his DOGE duties to focus on Tesla, which has seen a global sales drop. Here's Musk on a recent Tesla earnings call.
I think I'll continue to spend a day or two per week on government matters for as long as the president would like me to do so, and as long as it is useful.
Okay, so he's stepping back there. But since Musk has already aligned himself with President Trump, there have been questions about whether the administration would favor Musk's companies. And have we seen that so far?
Yeah, the White House has taken a number of big steps that will benefit Musk's business empire. For instance, the Commerce Department announced shaking up the requirements for this big federal broadband program that will basically open up billions of dollars in subsidies to Musk's Starlink satellite service. Musk's SpaceX may help build Trump's Golden Dome missile defense shield. The president turned the White House lawn into an infomercial for Tesla. On top of all of this, investigations into Musk's companies appeared to have slowed or have been completely sidelined by the layoff of federal workers or the closure of agencies. In sum, there's just been a fair amount of high-level policy moves that are benefiting Musk's corporations. But the Trump administration says, look, we're chopping red tape for all businesses. That's the aim, not just providing handouts to Musk companies. But Musk does have one big priority, and it's clearing the way for his autonomous taxi service he's calling CyberCab. Right now, those hurdles are mostly on the state level, but Musk says he's going to push hard for there to be a centralized federal authority to approve autonomous vehicles. Transportation experts say this is a pipe dream, but Musk is insisting on it.
So Musk is saying he's taking a step back from this government role next month. So then where does that leave the future of DOGE?
Yeah, well, DOGE appears to be entering another phase. The first phase we all know by now, right? Packs of young DOGE staffers showed up to agencies in Washington and set up shop and gain access to all sorts of super sensitive data systems. The second phase, which we're entering now, is focused on harnessing that data. Now, to what end? That is the question. Some of the data is being used to find immigrants in the U.S. without legal status and supercharging Trump's goal of speeding up mass deportations. Really sensitive IRS data is also being analyzed and entered into a master database. And again, it's just unclear right now what it's going to be used for, but it definitely has privacy experts quite concerned.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Lauren.
Tomorrow, Canada will elect a new government. And weighing heavily on the minds of voters there is U.S. President Donald Trump, who has imposed tariffs on Canada and threatened to annex it.
We're living next door to a government that seems to be hell-bent on expansion, intimidation, and of getting its own way. And the election is an opportunity for Canadians to express very deeply the anger they have, but also the sense of sadness they have.
Hear how Canadians are viewing this moment and rethinking their relationship with America later today on All Things Considered. Tune in on your radio, smartphone, or smart speaker. Years ago this week, the Vietnam War ended with the fall of Saigon in South Vietnam. In the long years of that war, both the U.S. and Vietnam aimed radio propaganda at each other. One of the communist North Vietnam's most notorious programs targeting U.S. GIs was fronted by one woman nicknamed Hanoi Hannah. Reporter Na Pham brings us this story from Hanoi.
Hanoi Hannah, one of the most recognizable voices from North Vietnam during the war.
How are you, G.I. Joe? It seems to me that most of you are poorly informed about the going of the war, to say nothing about a correct explanation of your presence over here.
For 8 years, from 1965 to 1973, she broadcast to the American troops serving in South Vietnam. John Rockhold, an American veteran who was stationed in the Mekong Delta in the early 1970s and now resides in Ho Chi Minh City, recalls.
You could listen to Hanoi Hannah almost throughout the southern Vietnam, and there was no restrictions or anybody saying that you could not listen to that. And in a way, it gave you a different view from just listening to the radio programs put out by the U.S. government and the military.
Hanoi Hannah's real name was Chinh Thi Ngoc. She was born in 1931 in Hanoi into a prominent business family. Ngoc died in 2016, but for Chinh Lu, a former colleague and close friend, memories of her remain fresh.
Our family is very close. Chinh Ngoc came to our family to learn English along with some of my sister. But later on, a lot from the BBC, English by radio, and the Voice of America, standard English.
Chinh Thi Ngoc joined communist-run Radio Voice of Vietnam as an announcer in 1955 under the name Thu Huong. 10 years later, when the first U.S. combat troops entered Vietnam and the war became known here as the Anti-American War, she was assigned to do a radio bulletin directed at the American soldiers 3 times a day.
Defect, G.I., it is a very good idea to leave a sinking ship. They lie to you, G.I. You know you cannot win this war.
She read them news scripted by the military, played anti-war music, and read out the names of G.I.s killed in action and even their hometowns to demoralize them.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone?
Did she believe in what she was talking about?
Oh, sure. She completely believed in what she does, believed in the meaning of it, and very proud of it. She's very wholeheartedly devoted to the job.
There are contradicting opinions about the effectiveness of Hanoi Hannah's radio programs. The Vietnamese said her voice induced, quote, fear and regret into American soldiers, but it is not known if any soldier defected as a result of her broadcast. U.S. veteran John Rockhold.
It wasn't very psychological warfare. When we listened to it, we liked the music she played, but most of the stuff she was saying was, we took it as funny, you know, laughing about it. After a while, you started to realize, too, that the material she was using, she could have got that from a lot of American military broadcasting.
This week, as Vietnam celebrates its victory over the U.S. half a century ago, there's been a lot of talks inside the country about the role of propaganda. Hanoi Hannah's last broadcast was in 1973, as U.S. troops were leaving Vietnam. The Voice of Vietnam Today broadcast in 13 foreign languages, but the real propaganda war is fought over the Internet. For NPR News, I am Na Pham in Hanoi.
Sheila is a kid who lives in a book, and she has a problem. She no longer fits on the page. After a summer growth spurt, she has to bend over to see people reading her book.
She tipped her head sideways, and there they were. Goodness, had she grown that much during the summer? This changed everything for Sheila. She knew that as the main character of a book, it was important for the readers to be able to see her. Well, they could see her, but only about up to her neck.
So, should she shrink herself to fit in? Gina Davis, the actor known for A League of Their Own and Thelma and Louise, among many other roles, is the author and illustrator of this new children's book called The Girl Who Was Too Big for the Page. And she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So you're tall yourself. Is this book autobiographical? Did you feel a bit out of place when you were a kid?
Oh, yes. I was always tall. I was, I think I was a tall baby. So I was always the tallest kid in class. And I so wanted to vanish into the woodwork. I was very shy and self-conscious and oh, it was torture. And I used to wish that I took up less space. It was really only as an adult that I not only became comfortable with it, but grew to absolutely love being tall. So yeah, it's very autobiographical.
And the character in this book, Sheila, realizes this dilemma she has, and she begins trying out solutions, like standing in weird positions to make herself look smaller. She bends over to tie her shoes. Did you do these things, or were these things you observed from other kids?
My mom knew that I was going to be tall, and she always insisted that I don't slump my shoulders, you know. So I had to stand up straight, but I found ways to stand, like with one hip thrust out. It's actually in the book, to seem a little bit shorter, or I'd lean on things or perch on the edges of things. So I just wasn't standing out so much.
So this is the book you wish you had had to read as a kid?
Oh, it would have been fabulous. When I was a kid, my favorite picture book was about a princess who was only like 2 feet tall. And I loved that book because I wanted to be her. I wanted to be special and petite and adorable instead of a great big gal.
Sheila also questions if she's interesting enough to be the subject of a book. And that is something that I could relate to. I feel like adults, kids, everyone can relate to, you know, self-doubt, imposter syndrome. Is that something that you, a famous actor in Hollywood, knows about?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes. All of that. I used to. It doesn't happen much anymore, but when I would get a job, I mean, I was very confident about my acting skills in general, but at the start of a new job with new people, I'd have a meltdown thinking they're going to find out I'm a fake, that I don't know what I'm doing, they're going to realize this is all a scam. And then once I start the job, I say, oh, well, no, never mind. I remember what to do. But it's been a constant in my life, sure.
So we know you're an actor. I didn't know you're an artist. You did the illustrations for this book. Have you always drawn?
Yes, I've always been very into art and crafts and things like that. As a kid, always drawing. I never, it was weird that you said artist, because I'm like, oh, wait, imposter syndrome. No, I'm not an artist. I just draw pictures.
You're a published artist now.
But now
news
I guess,
to break to you.
Oh, do I have to give in to that now? Yeah, I'm like, well, I just do like little drawings. I'm not really an artist. But yeah, I always have. I love to draw.
So you've written your first children's book, a picture book. You've illustrated it. You've written the story. Are the creative juices flowing now? Are you going to write more children's books? Are there other stories you have in your head that you need to write?
Well, you know, I may very well. I don't know. I haven't got a very specific idea yet, but I'm definitely interested. And I had thought about it a lot over the years, that it would be really fun to do a children's book that I could also illustrate. So I'm sure something may come up.
That's Gina Davis, actor and now children's picture book author. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Many members of Congress do not face competitive primaries. But as NPR's Elena Moore reports, that may change next year.
Around the country, a growing group of Democrats in their 20s and 30s are launching campaigns for Congress. And their announcements have a shared theme.
These do-nothing Democrats? It's time for leadership that puts the people first.
Democrats in Washington need backbone, courage, innovation, and yes, some fire in the belly.
Their goal? Unseating Democratic incumbents in the House of Representatives and replacing them with new voices. California's Jake Rakove is one of those candidates. The 37-year-old political strategist is running to represent the state's 32nd congressional district, part of Los Angeles County. He's challenging 15-term incumbent Brad Sherman, who Rakove worked for in 2017.
It's not an age thing. I think it's become an age thing just because the people who have been there for so long are now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. I would love to go back and ask him at 40, do you think you'll still be doing this at 70? And I'd love to hear that answer because I don't think he would say yes.
Rakove says millennial and Gen Zers see the future much differently than older generations. He says it's a worldview born out of multiple events that have defined their early adult lives. For Rakove, he remembers graduating college in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis.
If that's my kind of experience when I'm in Congress, I'm going to legislate with that mind view.
Many of his key policies are also designed to draw contrast with his former boss. He's pledging to hold in-person town halls each month and says Sherman hasn't been active enough in the district. Though the congressman says he's held well over 200 town halls during his nearly 30-year tenure. Rakove is also advocating for term limits, capping House members at 10 years.
We will never change anything if we do not change who we send to D.C. And if we can't have these honest-to-God conversations with ourselves as a party in our safest seats, how do we expect to have that conversation with voters in swing districts?
34-year-old George Hornado is pushing a similar message.
We need to get rid of this allegiance to outdated concepts like incumbency and seniority, and we need to think about how do we lift up the best candidates.
Hornado has done stints in the Obama administration and Pete Buttigieg's 2020 presidential campaign. Now he's challenging incumbent Andre Carson for Indiana's 7th congressional district. Carson has held the seat since 2008, but Hornado says he's coasted for too long. He points out that Carson has repeatedly lagged behind most of his Democratic colleagues in getting legislation passed, including in recent years where Democrats had a majority in the House.
This community does not care about legacy. This community is looking for action.
The congressman defends his time in office and says he's brought over $1 billion back to the district. But with a resume in both national politics and local organizing, Hornado says he's right for the job.
We know that there is appetite for new leadership, and voters are going to get a chance to make a choice.
Amanda Littman is the founder of Run for Something, a group that helps first-time Democratic candidates run for state and local office. She supports new candidates primarying incumbent Democrats, but she also has a word of caution.
To take on an incumbent elected official is a really big task. It's why most people don't do it, because it's nearly impossible.
She says these lawmakers typically have a leg up, from access to large fundraising networks and a bully pulpit to just more practice. There have been exceptions, like in 2018, when New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pulled off a major upset. So it's possible, but Littman says for every AOC, there were dozens of candidates who couldn't take out the incumbent. Elena Moore, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
European leaders have been shocked at the Trump administration's apparent tilt towards Russia in negotiating a deal to end the war in Ukraine. But NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says he doesn't see it that way.
President Trump's team and he himself really tried to, in an even-handed way, bring this whole process forward. It will mean compromises on all sides.
We speak with him on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. The tomb of Pope Francis is now open to the public. Pilgrims began arriving there this morning as a special mass was held in St. Peter's Square. Church cardinals are expected to start planning this week for the conclave to choose the next pope. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip say they have received the remains of 51 Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes in the last 24 hours. Gaza's health ministry says the overall Palestinian death toll has surpassed 52,000 since the war broke out. The first black labor secretary in U.S. history has died. Alexis Herman was 77 years old. She's being remembered as a civil rights trailblazer. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lauren Freyer. The U.S., like many post-industrial nations, is facing falling birth rates. Countries such as Japan, Singapore, and Korea have tried paying couples to have more children. Some offer free childcare, subsidized housing for families, and others have even engaged in matchmaking with little luck. But if this trend continues, the worry is that there will be fewer young people to support a growing number of old people. Here's President Trump in 2023.
And we will support baby bonuses for a new baby boom. How does that sound? That sounds pretty good. I want a baby boom.
And the White House is entertaining a variety of policy proposals, from pro-natalist groups to reverse this trend. Lyman Stone has been studying this issue for years and is a prominent figure in that movement. He's the director of the Pronatalism Initiative at the Institute for Family Studies, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be with you.
So I guess just first give us a definition of pronatalism. I think we might know what it is, but maybe not know that word.
Yeah, it literally just means in favor of births or more births. So if you're a person who thinks that it's not a good thing that U.S. fertility rates have fallen by 25% in the last 15 years, if you're a person that thinks it would be good if births were higher, then you are a pronatalist.
The worry is that it will lead to fewer young people supporting an economy of no workers and mostly older folks, retirees, and that's expensive.
To be honest, I don't think that's actually the biggest problem with falling fertility. I think the biggest problem with falling fertility is we know from decades of high-quality surveys that American women, on average, want to have about 2.2 to 2.3 kids, and yet they're only going to have 1.6. The average woman is going to be missing half a child, or rather, we could say every other woman is going to be missing a child.
And so what are the best ways to reverse this decline?
Well, most of the decline is driven by one factor, and that is declining marriage. It's just that people are getting married later and getting married less at all. So we need to be thinking about, yes, the cost of childbearing. Things like a child tax credit are useful, but we also need to think about why people aren't marrying. And a big factor is housing. If people can't afford a house, they're less likely to get married. And so we need to be thinking about making housing more affordable by building more of the types of houses that people want to start a family in. That means not just small apartments.
What do you think about the ideas being entertained by the White House? There's a proposal for $5,000 for every new baby born. There are suggestions of government-funded programs to educate women on menstrual cycles so they can better conceive. Idea of a national medal of motherhood for those who bear lots of children.
So look, if the White House wants to try 25 different things, I'm in favor of them trying 25 different things. A bigger child tax credit is the most important place to start. After that, things like baby bonuses, love it. Great. I'm all in favor. you know, other things, providing fertility awareness education, which I should note is not just about menstrual cycles, right? Because it turns out a lot of fertility delay is because people are badly educated about how to make babies. Our sex ed is all about how not to make babies, and we don't really tell people how to make babies when the time comes that they want to.
Immigrants tend to have a higher birth rate. Is that not just like a really good answer to your concerns?
It doesn't matter how many immigrants come into the country. If the people who are here, whether they're immigrants or natives, doesn't matter, if they're still having half a kid less than they say they want, that's still a problem, right? So look, I'm all in favor of a higher rate of legal regulated immigration. It just is totally irrelevant for the question of family formation.
This movement to increase the birth rate attracts people from really like all over the ideological spectrum, including some people who've been, you know, labeled extreme. There's been support from white supremacist groups for, you know, white women to have children. So my question is there some baggage here? Does any of that bother you?
Look, a couple weeks ago, I spoke at the Natalism Conference. And there were speakers there that I think The Guardian referred to some of them as far-right white supremacists. That is so antithetical to everything I believe. And then a couple weeks after that, I was presenting papers at the Population Association of America, a big demography conference. And there were a lot of people at that conference who believe that fetuses aren't people, and so it's okay to kill them. I think those are both bad views. But I also say, if one were to go and like talk to a bunch of white supremacists, what one would actually find is that they tend to complain about high birth rates. Most white supremacists are not out there saying, let's have a bigger child tax credit. Why? Because they worry that it will create dysgenic fertility. That is, it will subsidize breeding by people they see as unfit. People who have these really like hardcore racist beliefs, they're not pronatalists. They don't support any of these pronatal policies.
What do you say to young people who are really concerned about overpopulation and that's why they're not having children?
I have three kids and my fourth is going to be born in October. And the most terrifying thing to me is the idea that the world that I am going to leave them is going to be so deteriorated that the inheritance I give to them is not one of honor and of something they can be proud of and of a world full of joy, but of one of suffering and loss. So, and climate change, and beyond climate change, things like deforestation, accumulation of various pollutants, all these things, these are some of the most credible threats to my ability to provide a good life for my children in the long run. And so I think we absolutely have to tackle this.
That's Lyman Stone, director of the Pronatalism Initiative at the Institute for Family Studies. Thank you so much.
It's good to be with you.
Gold is considered a safe investment during times of financial uncertainty and turmoil, which explains the historic run this precious metal has been having. Last week, it briefly topped $3,500 per ounce for the first time ever, and J.P. Morgan is forecasting that gold could get above $4,000 per ounce next year. So what does this mean for people who work in the gold business? Well, John Dineen is the manager of Sol's Jewelry and Loan Pawn Shop in Omaha, Nebraska, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the value of gold is hitting historic highs. What does that mean for what you're seeing in your shop?
You know, it definitely has picked up quite a bit just in these last couple months with the articles that are out there talking about how gold is getting higher and higher. And, you know, it definitely has piqued people's interest in coming in, selling items, but also purchasing as well.
And what kind of items are people bringing in to sell?
You know, we're seeing everything across the board. We have the collectors of your gold and silver coins that, since gold's getting so high and in the past couple of years through COVID and everything, they were purchasing precious metals. Well, now their investments are going high enough that they want to cash out. And then you have your other clients that are going, boy, I've got all this excess jewelry in my jewelry cases. Let's take it in, see what this gold chain is worth, and get the cash for it.
And they're walking out of your shop with a lot of money, or a lot more than they would have 6 months ago or a year ago. Or
you're exactly right. In 2010, 2011, you know, gold was right around 1800, and people then talked about, well, it's going to hit 2000. A lot of people are like, no, it's not going to hit that. Well, boy, we've surpassed that. Then they said, okay, it's going to 3000. And now guess what? We're there, and people are bringing in their gold chains, rings, and they're walking out with substantial money, and they're going, boy, I mean, this is well worth it.
And what are they telling you about, like, why they're selling right now?
Definitely, I think it's the articles, it's the news, it's what they're seeing out there. Plus, with, you know, a lot of cost of goods right now, people are having a rough time a little bit. And so they definitely have money and value in their jewelry. So they're coming in and they're selling those items, you know, to maybe help pay bills.
Mm. So we're talking about selling gold, but is it actually a good time to buy as an investment? And if you are buying, like, what kind of gold is best? Is it jewelry? Is it gold bars? I mean, I don't even know the different carats, 24, 48. Give me some advice.
It's hard to say right now if it's a great investment because, boy, like I said, you know, when it was 1800, 1900, did I ever think it could get here? No. Now when they're talking 4, 4,500, 5,000 gold, boy, nothing's impossible right now. But what we do tell all of our clients when they do come in, if you're going to invest in gold, the best way is coins, bars. That is pure gold. That's 24 karat. When you get into jewelry, it's not a horrible investment, but you do have the different carats there. 10 karat, 14 karat, 18 karat. And all that means is the purity that you're looking at. So, you know, of course, the novice, when they're seeing online or looking at the stocks and they're seeing gold at 3,500, well, that's for a pure one troy ounce of 24 karat gold. So when you break up like 14 karat jewelry, which is 58.5% pure, then you have to kind of do a little math. So I tell people, if you want to get into the investment side, get into the coin side, it's just a lot easier.
Pure gold, coins, bars, and 24 karat is the top. I didn't even know that.
Is the top, yes.
It shows you what I have or don't have in my jewelry box.
In your forte there. Well, we'll teach you.
Spoken like a man who runs a gold shop. That's John Dineen, manager of Souls Jewelry and Loan Pawn Shop in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
What are the odds that two original musical comedies based on real historical stories, which feature corpses, land on Broadway at the same time? You don't need to calculate that because the British show Operation Mincemeat and the American show Dead Outlaw are entertaining audiences on Broadway right now. Jeff London has this report.
Your mom is dead. Your dad is dead. Your brother's dead. And so are you.
Andrew Durand, a living, breathing actor, spends half of Dead Outlaw playing Elmer McCurdy, a troubled young wannabe train robber. Then, in the second half of the show, he plays his mummified corpse, standing up stock still in a wood coffin. Durand says the show's director told him there could be a dummy in the coffin.
But I think it's going to be really impactful and important to actually have the person in there to remind the audience of the humanity of this corpse that was sort of ignored all these decades as people were making money off of his dead back. So that sort of inspired me and gave me the footing to say, like, okay, it's an important part of the story and the storytelling, so I can do it.
It's an audacious aspect of a show which looks at the true history of a man who tried and failed to become an outlaw. He was shot dead in 1911 by a posse, and then after his corpse went unclaimed, he became a sideshow attraction. His mummified remains were found in a California amusement park in 1976.
This idea is decades and decades in the making.
Songwriter David Yazbek, who wrote The Band's Visit, learned the story from a college friend. He started doing research, eventually wrote some songs with another musician, and then turned it into a musical.
It is ultra-American. It's all the interesting stuff. Fame, greed, crime, mortality,
There's guns aplenty.
If you want to do a sideshow, your classic 10-in-1, you gotta have a mummy to make the suckers come. It gets a man to thinking, a lump inside his throat, and that goes in the wallet. I keep inside my coat.
If Dead Outlaw is ultra American, Operation Mincemeat is very British. The show is based on a real false flag operation MI5, the British intelligence service, concocted to convince the Nazis that they were not going to invade Sicily. They had a corpse wash up on the Spanish coast with made-up documents saying the Allies were invading elsewhere.
It's not about armies and invasions and fighting on the ground.
Zoe Roberts is one of the show's creators and plays many roles, from the officer supervising the operation to Ian Fleming, who was part of the unit.
What it is about a small team of people trying to achieve something extraordinary. Mm. It's almost like a spy caper or a heist. It's Ocean's 11 in the war with a dead body.
While we never see the corpse in Operation Mincemeat, he's indicated by a hat and a briefcase, what both shows share is a sense of theatrical play. Their small casts perform multiple roles, and there's a lot of gender bending. Jack Malone, who won an Olivier Award in London, plays an American pilot, a coroner, and Hester Leggett, a stalwart MI5 secretary.
I describe it as the closest thing you can get to childhood level of play, like elementary school level of play. The costumes is the hard part, and then switching characters, very fun, very easy.
And why did we meet in the middle of a war? What a silly thing for anyone to do. Your sister sends her love, of course, and your mother is the same as ever.
Songwriter David Yazbek says where many Broadway shows resort to expensive scenic effects, there's much value in ingenuity and simplicity.
Seeing that there are very, very creative solutions behind the scenes, and then the value in letting the audience use their imaginations instead of just slamming them with, you know, visual tropes and expensive effects and stuff like that.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Joe Young is dead. Bert Connery's dead. Glenn Gould is dead. S.O.I.U.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Aisha Roscoe is back next week. I'm Lauren Freyer.
Look at them dead. Look at me dead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from Subaru, in partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
Take the legs from some old table. I'll take the arms from some old chair. I'll take the neck from some old bottle. And from a horse, I'll take the head. I'll take the hands and face from off the clock. And baby, when I'm through, I'll get more loving from the dumb dummy than I ever got from you.